Service led by the Reverend Ernie Ray. Now on FM, our book of the week, the new biography of Rachel Holmes, tells the story of Karl Marx's remarkable daughter. In today's episode, it's 1889, and Eleanor Marx is in a free love union with the faithless and dishonest Edward Aveling. She remains close to her godfather, Friedrich Engels, and Lenchen, who was her nanny and is now Engels' housekeeper. Meanwhile, her campaigning and activism reaches new heights. Eleanor Marx, A Life, is read by Tracy Ann Oberman.
The mighty Independent Labour Party emerged out of the battle-seared terrain of the British left in the late 19th century. Records of the time reveal Eleanor always at the absolute seeing eye of the storm. Innumerable meetings with key political figures of the period took place in her smoky, gaslit garret. Eleanor convened, she caucused, she networked. Surviving photographs represent this graphically. Occasionally, she's caught head and shoulders above an attentive gathering, listening to her speak from a platform, dray wagon, or industrial packing case. Or she's there, leaning in the doorframe, behind a crowd of men assembled for the group conference picture. In the 1890s, she was given a new name by British socialists when she took up the leadership of the gasworkers. Our Old Stoker. By the final decade of the 19th century, Eleanor Marx had become a national figure, mother of the radical British nation to her friends and followers, strident blue stocking and harridan to her enemies. 1889 was the year of the famous Paris Exhibition. Socialist Europe was divided, and two rival congresses were held in Paris. Eleanor's role was to undo the schism. Once she arrived in Paris, she barely had time to step outside the conference venue. She was chief interpreter from French and German into English. She translated the business of the Congress, including the resolution in favour of an international 8-hour working day, and one for the establishment of an international labour demonstration on the 1st of May. Eleanor spent her few snatched breaks with her nephews, Johnny and Edgar Longue. Edgar remembered her ever after as my loved Aunt Tussie, and her taking them to see the Sonne Lumière show illuminating Gustav Eiffel's ironwork tower, the centrepiece of the exhibition. Engels thought it a monstrosity, and the whole exposition vulgar capitalist gimcrack. Aunt Tussie brought her nephews back to London with her after the Congress. Johnny and Edgar stayed for several months, treated with visits to the zoo and walks on Hampstead Heath. Engels and Lenchen loved having the Longue boys to visit. Engels let them sit at his desk and use his ink, paper and blotter. Eleanor again silently wondered at his contrasting aloofness with Lenchen's son, Freddie Daymut, evidenced by his entirely uncharacteristic withdrawal whenever Freddie came to the house. Shortly before they returned to France, Johnny and Edgar were at her side when Aunt Tussie addressed a crowd of 100,000 people in Hyde Park in support of the dock strike. The dockers struck on the 14th of August. Within a fortnight, the great trading Thames was eerily silent. Shipping magnates, bankers, and Tories and Liberals in Parliament were terrified. Never had industrial action brought mighty London trade to such a standstill. The famished, broken-down dock labourers endured appalling employment conditions. They were forced to physically fight each other every morning to get work. Now they had collectivised, implemented a mass strike, and pulled in after them every trade and support service in any way connected with shipping. The dockers ultimately won some significant benefits, and the new Dock, Wharf, Riverside and Labourers' Union was formed. In 1921, it became the Transport and General Workers' Union. Soon afterwards, Eleanor and Edward went up to the Trades Union Congress in Dundee. The success of the dock strike and the gas workers' strike that preceded it buzzed in every meeting. Earlier in the year, the London gas workers won the right to an 8-hour day. Gas workers were required to have considerable skill and endurance in a permanently combustible atmosphere, yet were considered unskilled labourers. For almost 20 years, gas workers had tried, and failed, to organise for better pay and conditions. Now, in 1889, they finally succeeded. Union leaders Will Thorne and Ben Tillett were unequivocal about Eleanor's role in the gas workers' strike and the dock strike. These men recognised hard graft. Ben Tillett remembered, "She worked unceasingly, literally day and night, a vivid and vital personality, with great force of character, courage and ability." One of the most important resolutions of the 1889 Paris Congress was to establish May Day as an annual demonstration of the international solidarity of labour in the demand for a legal 8-hour day. Eleanor spent the first months of her 35th year working to get this implemented in Britain. She rallied support all over the country. On the 4th of May, 1890, upwards of 250,000 congregated in Hyde Park and bore testimony to the effectiveness of her campaigning, alongside the other almost exclusively male union leaders. Engels described the demonstration as nothing short of overwhelming. Eleanor made a speech that first May Day and concluded with Shelley's thunderous invocation to working-class Englishmen and women in the Masque of Anarchy. "Ye are many, they are few." In November, Eleanor was called to Lenchen's deathbed. Helen Demut died, aged 70, from untreatable cancer. Freddie Demut was now motherless, and as far as Eleanor knew, in the painful position of having a living father who unaccountably refused to acknowledge him. No one pressed Lenchen for confirmation of Freddie's paternity on her deathbed. She commanded a stoical silence. It was obvious she would reveal nothing that might compromise Engels while he was still alive. Yet Engels was a libertarian who'd written more cogently than anyone she knew on bourgeois sexual hypocrisy. Between 1890 and 1893, Eleanor was in perpetual motion. Her speeches, campaigning and reports, breaking of bread and beer after Congress sessions required determination and great stamina. In 1891, Edward's health began to deteriorate. His illnesses were now manifestly real. "Edward is far from well," Eleanor anxiously told her sister. Politics commanded Eleanor's full attention, and as a means to consolidate the momentum for a new independent Labour Party, Eleanor and Edward, when his health allowed, focused on forming international alliances. Eleanor seemed indefatigable. Congress succeeded Congress. She translated, interpreted, and kept verbatim reports using her much-loved typewriter. Though always in the midst of the fray, a refrain of solitude emerges during the years of the early 1890s. "Though I am always busy, I am also very lonely." The melancholy to which Eleanor had been prey since her 20s cast a deeper darkness on the winter days of 1893. Edward's frequent absence exacerbated her depression. His only constant source of income was coaching and from writing introductory science books. This gave him plenty of happy hours, dallying with his young student researchers in the British Museum. Eleanor signed off her pre-Christmas letter to her sister, remarking that Edward is out supping with some theatrical friends. "As it is one and my fire is out, I shall say good night." She's long given up waiting for him to come home. It's a dismal image of unwanted aloneness in a vital, naturally gregarious spirit. Freddie and his son Harry Demut alleviated Eleanor's loneliness. Eleanor and Freddie spent more and more time together, chatting and eating together by each other's firesides in Holborn and Hackney, and taking the 12-year-old Harry out for long rambles. As Freddie was a shop steward, socialist and active unionist, they had much in common. Freddie had left the home of his foster parents as soon as he was of legal age. He had no further communication with them, but he never lost touch with his mother, Lenchen. Hard-working, self-reliant, interested in everything, Freddie was a resolute autodidact. So why did Engels behave like a tetchy demon towards his only son, whom he refused to acknowledge? It was public knowledge that Marx had bequeathed exclusive rights to his intellectual property to Eleanor and her sister Laura, to be held in trust by Engels for the duration of his lifetime. When Engels' health deteriorated towards the end of the year, he sensed he was mortally ill. Confronted by the final fact of his mortality, he acted swiftly to take additional measures to secure the papers and manuscripts in accordance with Marx's wishes and his own good conscience. During November, Engels added a supplementary clause that had a significant bearing on Eleanor. He decided to separate his own manuscripts from everything in Marx's handwriting. Everything in Marx's hand went to Eleanor. Engels' own manuscripts, and critically, the correspondence between Marx and Engels, went to the German Social Democratic Party. This division would make it impossible for Eleanor to compile her father's letters for publication. This was a difficult position in which to place Eleanor as Marx's official literary executor. In March 1895, Engels was diagnosed with throat cancer. By May, the pain and swelling in Engels' neck was intolerable. He needed an operation, followed by recuperation by the seaside. He asked if Eleanor would join him. They shared eggnog and oysters and joked together. In the summer, Eleanor packed up Gray's Inn Square and moved herself and Edward to Orpington in Kent. Expecting her sister or Freddie to visit, Eleanor was astonished to find herself greeting Engels' great friend, Sam Moore, as her first visitor through the gate of her country cottage. Eleanor wondered if he had come to tell her personally that Engels was dead. But the news Sam brought was entirely unexpected. In that moment of shock, the axis of Eleanor's world lurched to an angle so sickening that she couldn't regain her balance or bearings. She tried to make sense of the story Sam was telling her. It couldn't be true. Karl Marx was Freddie Demuth's father, not Engels. Eleanor went immediately to London and straight to Engels' bedside. By the time she arrived, he could no longer speak. His throat swollen, in agonizing pain, Engels answered Eleanor's question by writing on a slate in the affirmative. Both beyond the power of speech, they stared at each other, mute with grief. All Engels could do was confirm the truth. He couldn't tell her anything more. This was her last meeting with Engels. She left in shock and returned to Kent. The next day, Engels became unconscious. Two nights later, on the evening of the 5th of August, he died. Simultaneously, Eleanor lost both her second father, Engels, and her idealization of her own father. It was the fact of not knowing, not the deed, that stunned her. If Freddie's paternity had not been kept a secret, it would have just been a part of who her father, Karl Marx, was. Instead, Eleanor was confronted by a tatty cliché, the truth brushed under the carpet. The past now seemed another country. She'd lost two fathers. She'd also gained a half-brother.
Tracy Ann Oberman reads the concluding instalment of Eleanor Marx, A Life, by Rachel Holmes at the same time tomorrow. The abridger was Julian Wilkinson and the producer was Elizabeth Allard.
What the Kitchen Cabinet isn't is a bunch of cooking tips. It's for anybody who's interested in food, and in my experience, that's pretty much everybody.
Jay Rayner and his culinary companions return to BBC Radio 4.
Why don't you try sea urchins?
Fiona, have you tried sea urchins?
I've never tried sea urchins.
Do you like oysters?
No.
Yeah, well, you're not going to like sea urchins. What was a toast sandwich?
Basically, what it was a piece of toast with two bits of bread on the outside.
It is a raucous half hour of rampant chat about the thing that makes us human, which is the way we eat.
The new series of The Kitchen Cabinet on Saturday morning at 10:30.